This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 5th from KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle. I'm Yuko Kodama. In today's program, United Nations' Ibrahim Gambari provides a report to the United Nations Security Council, the latest about Blackwater, and the World Bank and the United Nations have launched a stolen asset recovery initiative to help developing countries recover billions of dollars of looted funds. All this and more, but first these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A UN envoy has warned Burma's military junta of serious repercussions if it does not stop the ongoing crackdown on the country's political opposition. Heather Risby reports from the United Nations.
After meeting with the members of the Security Council, UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari said abuses continue in Burma, but expressed optimism about a possible dialogue between the government and opposition. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon sent Gambari to Burma to talk with the leaders of the military regime and to investigate reports of widespread abuses during the crackdown against pro-democracy protesters. During his four-day visit to Burma, Gambari held a series of meetings with senior generals and opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Ban Ki-moon has described the use of force on peaceful protesters as unacceptable, while the United States and the United Kingdom are calling for strict sanctions against the military regime. Security Council members China and Russia oppose sanctions. China is Burma's largest trading partner. Gambari is due to return to Burma next month for further talks with the military government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Pakistan is one day away from a highly contentious presidential election. A Supreme Court announcement today is the latest in a series of political twists in the run-up to the vote. Pakistan's parliament and four regional assemblies will decide who will rule the country for the next presidential term. But the High Court says that the winner cannot declare victory until the justices rule on last-minute challenges to the candidacy of President General Pervez Musharraf. The Supreme Court will begin hearing the cases on October 17th. A report released in Britain details claims by rejected asylum seekers who say they were beaten or abused during deportation. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
A team of lawyers, immigration centre visitors and campaign groups today released a dossier of 200 cases compiled over the past 2 years, detailing claims of abuse by rejected asylum seekers. Medical examinations performed by doctors corroborate the claims included in the report. Nearly all of the allegations implicate private security contractors employed by the government to carry out forced repatriation of failed asylum seekers. Operation procedures allow the contractors to use reasonable force when transporting deportees from removal centres to waiting planes. Individuals tell of receiving beatings by more than one escort at a time, or of violence accompanied by racist comments. One man who was imprisoned and tortured in the Republic of Congo suffered a fracture when escorts forced his hands backwards when he refused to sign a document. Another man from Cameroon has brought a civil claim for assault against the security company after an injury prevented his deportation. The private security firms involved in deportations refused to comment today. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Texas county that administers a private prison contract for a controversial immigration detention center may soon pull out of the deal. Ansel Hurst reports from Austin.
Williamson County commissioners voted this week to look into the possibility of terminating the county's contract with the Corrections Corporation of America. CCA is the private prison contractor that operates the T. Don Hutto Residential Center. Hutto is one of just two private immigrant detention facilities in the country that holds children. It primarily holds asylum seekers awaiting a final decision on their claims. Hutto has been the focus of a number of lawsuits in the past year. As the contract administrator, the county shares in the legal liability. Williamson County commissioners said that liability was the reason for their decision to look at terminating the contract 1 year early. The Williamson County commissioners will vote on Tuesday on whether to approve the draft letter terminating the contract. If they do so, Immigration and Customs Enforcement will likely have to find another county willing to share the liability for the controversial detention center. For FSRN, this is Ansel Hurz in Austin.
An Associated Press review of reports filed with the Center for Disease Control reveals that the number of mishaps at U.S. biolabs is significant and increasing. Kelly Ramirez has more.
The reports revealed more than 100 accidents and missing shipments involving anthrax, bird flu, monkeypox, and plague at 44 labs in 24 states since 2003. Nobody died, and regulators claimed that the public was never in danger. But Representative Bart Stupak of Michigan has said that a public health incident with potentially catastrophic results, quote, may be only a matter of time, unquote. The AP also reported that the number of incidents is increasing steadily as more labs are approved to handle the world's deadliest organisms. Mary Leah Kelly is the executive director of Tri-Valley Cares, an organization fighting a proposed biolab in the San Francisco Bay Area.
What is needed is an overarching national assessment of our biodefense capabilities. Everything that we've researched has told us that, in fact, the United States has an excess of biodefense capability and that we probably don't need to build anything new.
The number of labs has nearly doubled since 2004. Biolab safety is the subject of an ongoing congressional investigation. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari, who spent 4 days in Burma after the military's bloody crackdown on pro-democracy protests, briefed the United Nations Security Council on his mission there today. He indicated that Burma's actions affect the global community, that the global community is concerned about what has taken place in Burma, and to address the socioeconomic issues that underlie the recent demonstrations.
In terms of immediate steps, I would like to note that the authorities have already announced a relaxation of the curfew in Yangon and Mandalay, and reports indicate that visible military presence in the streets has been reduced. I've also been informed by the government that as of today, a total of 2,095 persons arrested in the course of demonstrations have been released, including 728 monks, and that more releases will follow as a direct result of my request to the authorities on behalf of the Secretary General.
That was UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari providing his report to the United Nations Security Council today. According to the Karen Connection, 12,000 people from Burma, most of whom are from the ethnic regions, have resettled in the U.S. since last year. An average of 300 people of Burma leave the refugee camps each week to other countries, and the struggle of the ethnic groups has had a history of decades. I spoke with Stephen Dunn, consultant for World Aid, a humanitarian organization specializing in Burma, and a Karen from the eastern region of Burma. Mr. Dunn, why has there been such a large number of people from Burma relocating to the U.S. lately?
Number one, the military regime is evil. They attack their own people, and only now is the world beginning to know about it because it's happening in the urban areas. But for years, this exact same thing, if not worse, has been happening in the ethnic areas. And the people that you see coming to the States right now are from those areas, refugees from those areas that have been burned out. The villages have been burned, rice fields mined, so they can't work and they can't exist in their own land anymore.
What is the interest in the ethnic areas?
The ethnic areas generally have the natural resources that Burma is very well known for. There's, of course, teak. Burma teak is famous. And now there's the natural gas. And then you have your gems, your rubies, and jade, of course. So all these are in the ethnic areas. And so because of the totally devastated economy, the regime needs a resource, and they are bent on getting those resources at any cost. What you have is these attacks to clear the lands where the resources can be gotten.
When was it that this started to really escalate in history?
1984. The generals realized that they had some sort of a isolationist policy before because they were saying, oh, we don't need the foreign countries sucking our blood. But in 1984, they realized that they could do better. So foreign investment started coming in. The generals had the money to buy the weapons. The weapons were coming in from China, India, Russia. And so the situation has deteriorated from 1984 until now.
The UN envoy Ibrahim Gambari recently spoke with the generals in Burma. What do you think of his efforts?
I think the international community and the UN needs to hold Gambari accountable because this cannot continue. He has met with the generals many times with no progress. What the UN is claiming as progress is that Gambari met with Thanh Shwe, the head of the junta, and now Thanh Shwe has made an announcement that if Aung San Suu Kyi will call off the foreign sanctions and not continue her stand for democracy, then he will talk to her.
Stephen Dunn is a consultant to World Aid and a Karen from the ethnic region of Burma. Thank you, Stephen Dunn. The World Bank and the United Nations have launched a stolen asset recovery initiative. The initiative is to help developing countries recover billions of dollars of looted funds, most of which are stashed in developed countries. But critics say some World Bank projects have in the past encouraged corruption by multinational companies, especially those operating in Africa. The bank is also accused of not doing enough to support African countries in their fight against corrupt multinational companies.
According to the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, the joint initiative between the UN and the World Bank to help developing countries recover looted funds becomes necessary given the harmful effects of corruption on developing countries.
The theft of public assets from developing countries is a grave and growing concern. The cross-border flow of the global proceeds from criminal activities, corruption and tax evasion is estimated to be more than $1 trillion per year. But the true cost of corruption far exceeds the value of the asset stolen. It has adverse effects on the delivery of basic social services. It has a particularly harmful impact on the poor. And it is a major obstacle to achieving our Millennium Development Goals.
President of the World Bank, Robert Zolik, explains how the bank will help in the anti-corruption initiative, which is also known as STAR.
Developing countries frequently lack the institutional capacity to locate and repatriate stolen assets. So this initiative will provide financial and technical assistance to strengthen the institutional capacity of government agencies to do so. And it will also help these countries bring their laws into compliance with the UN Convention Against Corruption.
But critics of the World Bank say some of the projects for which it offers developing countries loan not only encourage corruption, but also add to the debt burden of developing countries. Bode Olufemi is of the Environmental Rights Action, a Nigerian non-governmental organization that is critical of World Bank projects in Nigeria.
I strongly believe that the World Bank is guilty in the debt problem that we're having in developing countries because they did not do their work well. There was some level of, can I say, deliberate negligence or looking the other side on the part of World Bank officials when you see that the government is corrupt, when you see that the corporation that has taken money to do water project in Nigeria and abandoned it, and then you give same contract to another, that same corporation in Mali, in Swaziland, or in Botswana, and that same corporation, you know, all over 4 or 5 African countries have this pattern of abandoning projects, of leaking, you know, loans, of leaking resources, money into corrupt officials, into corrupt governments. The World Bank is guilty in that level.
The World Bank is also accused of a lukewarm attitude in its support of developing countries fighting corruption. One instance is when the government of Lesotho was investigating corruption among multinational companies that handled a World Bank assisted program. The World Bank was also reluctant to sanction one of the companies found guilty of corrupt practices while handling the contract. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The U.S. State Department announces new procedures in handling their affairs with Blackwater USA, video monitoring, active personnel oversight, and regional communication will help increase accountability of the private security firm's operations in and around Baghdad, said Press Secretary Sean McCormick. Catherine Jamul has more from Washington, D.C.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice recommended key changes in Baghdad's security contractor oversight. These changes come as State Department personnel pursue their investigation of the violent incidents of September 16th, where at least 11 Iraqis were killed by Blackwater employees. The State Department called for increased surveillance of Blackwater USA, one of the largest security contracting firms for diplomatic envoys in Iraq. Other changes will include sending U.S. security agents to accompany diplomatic convoys. State Department spokesperson Leslie Phillips describes how the security agents will help improve the accountability of security contractors.
A State Department employee will be there to witness for themselves any incidents that occur and would help us in determining what happened and if the actions taken by anybody in the convoy was appropriate.
The State Department already monitors all radio communication between units as standard procedure that dates back to the beginning of Blackwater involvement in diplomatic security. Now the State Department is calling for video cameras to be mounted on Blackwater vehicles. The new procedure would require units to record and archive all radio communications, as well as visual documentation from the new cameras. James Ross, the legal and policy director for Human Rights Watch, says that increased oversight of private security firms is essential. He supports the State Department's move to record and archive Blackwater's activities.
Ultimately, it is the United States that is responsible for the conduct of security personnel who are contractors, and that the U.S. can't pass the buck when they employ somebody else to do a job that, say, was previously done by U.S. service members. The U.S. does have an obligation. And so any steps that can be taken to ensure that when misconduct perhaps takes place, that the U.S. is in a stronger position to take action against it, that would be a good thing. So taping these operations and the like sounds like a good idea.
Finally, the department will coordinate closer communication between Blackwater convoys and the local U.S. military units. Security agents from the Department of State are already en route to Baghdad to begin accompanying Blackwater convoys. The FBI joined the investigation this week. Under existing contracts, FBI investigators would be provided security through Blackwater. However, Special Agent Richard Colco describes changes in FBI security procedures for this visit.
To avoid even the appearance of any conflict, the FBI team deployed from Washington to assist the State Department in the investigations of the events of September 16, 2007, will have any additional security needs provided by U.S. government personnel.
Martina Cowart, Director of Communications on the Project on Government Oversight, said increased reliance on federal contract work, which began during President Clinton's term and continued with President Bush, require the government to seriously audit the work of these contractors.
There are not enough internal checks and balances in federal agencies to guard against excessive outsourcing of government work. But we are concerned that there are not nearly enough people within agencies to look carefully at contracts to see if the companies are capable of doing the work, they're actually performing the work they've contracted for, and delivering the product or services that they are being paid for.
Based on the investigations, legislation passed yesterday by the House of Representatives would require legal proceedings if Blackwater employees are indicated in the wrongful death of Iraqi civilians or destruction of private property. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel.
It was Money Week in presidential election politics. The campaigns issued their third quarter reports, and the media jumped all over the story. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell brings us this week's political roundup.
All week, the political headlines have revolved around candidates' fundraising prowess. The Democrats again outraised the Republicans, and most notably, Republican Libertarian anti-war candidate Ron Paul raised an astonishing $5 million this quarter. As for the issues, the headlines sidestepped those. They extensively covered Senator Barack Obama's response to a question as to why he stopped wearing a flag pin on his lapel after September 11th.
I decided I won't wear that pin on my chest. Instead, I'm going to try to tell the American people what I believe will make this country great. And, you know, hopefully that will be a testimony to my patriotism.
Obama signed the Freedom Pledge this week, a guarantee to protect civil liberties and oppose torture. Senator Hillary Clinton is the only Democratic candidate who has not yet done so. And Senator Chris Dodd launched a new YouTube ad. He's taking advantage of a significant difference between him and his challengers, Obama, Clinton, and John Edwards. a difference that became apparent at a Democratic debate last week.
As Commander-in-Chief, that you will have all troops out of Iraq by January of 2013.
I will get that done.
Will you pledge that by January 2013, the end of your first term, more than 5 years from now, there will be no U.S. troops in Iraq?
I don't want to make promises not knowing what the situation is going to be 3 or 4 years out.
I agree with Barack. It is very difficult to know what we're going to be inheriting.
I cannot make that commitment.
And new voter initiatives have taken off running.
Hola, soy María Antonieta Collins.
This one is a get-out-the-vote candidate information site for Latinos called Vote for Your Future. Another is called Ballot Ground. In battleground states around the country, founder Dylan Lowe and his team will work to put out an out-of-Iraq initiative on the ballots to bring the anti-war contingency to the polls.
So it is our intention to send a very strong anti-war mandate to the next president and the next Congress. It is our intention to increase anti-war turnout in those states with the belief that the greater the turnout, the greater the mandate. And in the interim, it is our intention to ratchet up the pressure on those policymakers who continue to support the Bush war policy.
Christian conservatives are tossing around the idea of a third-party candidate if Rudy Giuliani wins the primary. Senator Sam Brownback and Governor Mike Huckabee have rejected that plan. It will guarantee a win for the Democrats, they say. And some more bad news for the Republican Party. A fifth senator, this time New Mexico's Pete Domenici, will not run for re-election. And the Republican Party is lamenting some other news. Idaho Senator Larry Craig announced he will stay in the Senate, despite previous announcements stating otherwise, and despite a guilty plea for a bathroom incident that a judge says must stand. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush is optimistic about the Washington-sponsored Middle East Peace Conference. Meanwhile, tense activity continues in the Middle East. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert this week signed a joint declaration setting an agenda for upcoming talks. These talks will follow next month's Middle East Peace Conference in Washington, D.C. Olmert voiced willingness to take part in such talks, yet refused that to be bound by any time frame. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will visit the region next week in a preparation for the upcoming peace summit. Meanwhile, several blasts have ripped through Gaza since the beginning of this week, leaving at least one dead and several others injured. Roadside bombs hit vehicles and posts of the Hamas-dominated government's executive force. Hamas's interior ministry arrested a number of Fatah supporters as suspects. Ismail Ridwan is a senior leader of Hamas in Gaza.
There are some chaotic elements that have been in contact with Ramallah-based parties. These elements have been carrying out some practices in order to destabilize security in Gaza.
The speaker refers implicitly to possible Fatah's involvement in the recent bombings. Also this week, Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Minister has demanded the release of all prisoners within the next few months after Israel released 89 out of approximately 12,000 Palestinian prisoners jailed in Israeli detention facilities. Israel says it was a goodwill gesture in the holy month of Ramadan. Gaza welcomed 3 prisoners while the West Bank received the others. All of them belong to the moderate Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Khalil Abu Baraka is a released prisoner who served half of a 7-year-long sentence.
Of course, we are happy, but we won't be completely happy until our brothers inside the jails are freed soon, hopefully. I call for the release of all prisoners, regardless of their affiliations, whether they are Hamas, Fatah, or any other group.
The Islamist Hamas government in Gaza has been outlawed by President Mahmoud Abbas after Hamas took over the coastal region in mid-June amidst a heightened power struggle with its rival Fatah party. Abbas also formed a caretaker government in Ramallah, comprised mainly of Fatah. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
Environmental groups this week announced a new campaign to demand that major coal industry financiers invest in renewable energy instead. Rainforest Action Network, Step It Up, and other environmental groups are targeting Bank of America and Citibank for supporting the coal industry with billions of dollars in credit lines and direct loans for coal companies. The groups calculate that Citibank finances 200 times more for fossil fuel energy than it does for alternative energy. Bank of America, 100 times more. In this two-part series, FSRN's Christina Onestad takes a look at the bank's funding histories. Today, she focuses on Citibank.
There are an estimated 150 pending proposals for coal power plants in the U.S. According to the Energy Information Administration, coal burning in the U.S. creates nearly 2 billion tons of greenhouse gases every year, and that's one-third of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, the leading cause of global warming. So environmentalists are targeting Citibank to stop funding coal power. Rebecca Tarbatten, Rainforest Action Network's campaign director, says Citibank is the country's largest financial backer for the coal industry.
Citi is the top underwriter for American Electric Power, which is the single largest greenhouse gas emitter in the U.S., as well as one of the top buyers of mountaintop removal coal from Appalachia. AEP is proposing to build 5 coal-fired power plants in the near future. Citi is also the top underwriter for Dynegy, that now incorporates LS Power. And this is the company that is proposing the largest build-out of coal-fired power plants of any corporation in the country, currently planning on building 8 plants around the U.S.
According to the group's website, dirtymoney.org, Citigroup also helped to finance a proposal to develop a coal plant in Florida's Everglades, a rare wetland home to the endangered panther and manatee, and a World Heritage Site. But the plan fell through with fierce public opposition this summer. Environmentalists hope public pressure can also change Citibank's funding policies. They'll be using public power and their money muscle. Leslie Lowe is with the ICCE, Interfaith Coalition for Corporate Responsibility, an investment firm with over $110 billion worth of shares in the U.S. stock market.
As investors, we are looking at the future return from these plants. It is clear that we will have carbon limits in this country. It will impose a cost for carbon pollution, so that every coal plant that emits more CO2 is going to be a liability long term. We, as people of faith, are committed to seeing global warming stopped. To embark on a program of building new coal power plants, it is to profit from the destruction of the natural world, from the destruction of communities. It is, under any faith-based view of the world, blasphemy and a sin.
Lowe says their shareholders will be in discussions with Citigroup. Citigroup declined a live interview but did issue this public statement, quote, "Citi is taking a responsible and strong leadership position on climate change. Moreover, we have committed $50 billion, more than any other institution, over the next 10 years for climate-friendly efforts," unquote. That's $5 billion a year. Tarbatten says it's minuscule in comparison to Citigroup's energy funding history.
Citi underwrote more than $38 billion for the energy industry in 2006. And that same year, Citi underwrote just one transaction for alternative energy.
Citigroup's climate policy mentions support for efficiency, alternatives, and carbon sequestration, but does not mention renewables, solar, or wind power. In 2001, the U.S. Department of Energy estimated strong wind areas that cover 6% of U.S. land could supply more than 1.5 times the electricity use in the U.S. Rainforest Action Network, in conjunction with Step It Up, are organizing mass actions for November 3rd, urging coal backers, Bank of America, and Citigroup to start investing in renewable energy sources instead of coal. I'm Christina Onestad at KZYXNZ reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
From KBCS in Bellevue, Seattle, I'm Yuko Kodama.